Well, the general election is 11 days away. Last Sunday and this, we have set ourselves the task, the potentially rather risky task, of asking whether Christians have anything to say on the big issues the country faces. And this morning, as you know, my topic is immigration. These aren't political sermons, at least not ones in the sense of suggesting how you might vote. But they are sermons about politics. And politics is the art and science of securing the common good of the community through government. And that matters to God. For rule is his special subject. It's the family business. He's always on the scene. And political parties would do rather better if they didn't neglect that. C.S. Lewis used to joke that the only thing that we learn from political sermons are which newspapers are taken at the rectory. Well, our hope in these talks is not to hear the newspapers and what they have to say, but the Bible and what God has to say. An Anglican slum vicar in the 19th century East End put this well. If you love Jesus Christ, he said, you will care about the drains. And of course, he had a point. And the bottom line this morning is much the same. If you love Jesus Christ, you will care about immigration. But what will that look like in a debate that's often so lethally slippery, with the ground moving beneath our feet where a wrong word, a clumsily expressed thought, has you labeled either at one end as a bleeding heart liberal or at the other end as a closet racist? The debate plunges us, doesn't it, into a realm of confused terminology, of slippery statistics, of inflammatory remarks, and of raised tempers. Where in the past, the emphasis in Britain had been on asylum, taking in people fleeing from violence or persecution, now the issue is mass migration, with many further complex issues in play in the background. We know them: national security, terrorism, Islamization. And then, too, there are the bigger issues affecting the whole world: globalization, European integration, increased labor mobility, improved communication, cheaper travel. All these things have seen net migration soar, treble, since the mid-1990s. And people are worried. The British Social Attitude Survey shows that 77% of the British public want to see immigration reduced. 56% by a lot. And, you know, that's not just a white British thing. Many first and second generation migrants share exactly that view. Current levels of net migration, 10 million people, will be added in the next 20 years. That's another London. It's 9 Birminghams. EU migration has doubled since 2010 alone. Between 2001 and 2012, 57% of population growth has been due to net migration, and of that, 93% comes to England, which is now the second most densely populated country in the EU, after the Netherlands. And, excluding islands and city-states, the seventh most densely populated country in the whole world. Here's David Coleman, professor of demography at Oxford University, and not, I suspect, a man overly given to hyperbole. He has written recently, many of the consequences of large-scale migration are damaging. We do not need up to 13 million more people by the mid-century. Almost all that increase will be immigrants and their children. It will not make the UK a happier or richer place. Crowding and congestion will have entirely negative effects, increasing pressure on schools, hospitals, and particularly housing. That's why, you know, with the NHS and the economy, immigration has been in the big three of political concern. Ed Miliband was surely right to say recently we need to be ready to say that it's not prejudiced to worry about immigration. It's understandable. The other side of this, of course, is that part of the UK's genius since the Norman Conquest has been to benefit from and be enriched by waves of immigration at various stages. The Huguenots in the 16th and 17th century, Jews from Poland and Russia at the end of the 19th century, and then from Nazi Germany in the 20th century, Irish migrants in the 19th and 20th centuries, West Indian immigrants in the 1950s and 60s. What is different now, though, and without doubt more complicated, is the scale. You remember the arrival of the East African Asians in the mid-1970s? There were 27,000 spread over 2 years. Last year, alone, in the UK, immigration was running at 20,000 a month. Difficult to believe that until 1982, we were net exporters of people. How much has changed so quickly? And, you know, the sheer agony of some of this has been in our faces in the last fortnight, hasn't it, with the human tragedy of the Mediterranean. 31,500 people have crossed from North Africa to Italy and Greece this year alone. 2,000 people have drowned in the waters of the Mediterranean since last autumn. Many countries across the world are affected. Not just our own problem here. There are 3 million Syrian refugees at the moment and 6.5 million displaced people in that country, which is a country with only 23 million people to start with. So far this year, we've taken 143. We had 32,000 asylum applications in 2014. Germany had 203,000. We're not in this alone. This isn't just a British problem. How bad does it need to be to get on an unseaworthy boat with your little children? Or to suffocate in a container lorry at Calais? Or to get electrocuted clinging to Eurostar? Or to freeze in the arches of a plane trying to get into Heathrow, the wheel arches of a plane trying to get into Heathrow? You're not doing that, I suspect, just for a shared hostel room in Wolverhampton or a crack at job seekers' allowance. Pity our politicians trying to sort some of this out. This is not easy territory. As Pope Francis said, immigration is an issue where we need to remember how to cry. I was reminded of J.K. Galbraith's quip in reply to Rab Butler's, politics is the art of the possible. Galbraith said, politics is not the art of the possible. It consists in choosing between the disastrous and the unpalatable. And it sometimes feels a little bit like that with immigration policy, doesn't it? As Rachel Chabie, the journalist, said in the Times this week, we want a joined-up world, but not the people in it. That's the problem. On a recent school visit to Derby, Tristram Hunt, the shadow education minister, didn't perhaps pay as much attention as he might to W.C. Fields' caution to performers about not working with children or animals. He tackled what looked like a bright 10-year-old and asked who he would vote for. UKIP, came the reply. Very good, said the immaculately polite Mr. Hunt. And why? And the little boy said, to get all the foreigners out of the country. Well, much embarrassment, and the conversation moved on. It's horrible, isn't it, that a boy has got that from somewhere, has picked up that attitude. Goodbye, 13% of our fellow citizens. Goodbye, 37% of Londoners. No Christian could ever think like that. As our text, and I'm getting there, Leviticus 19:34 makes clear. And in fairness, that's not even what UKIP is saying. though the extraordinary rise of that party, with all its concern about the EU and all its ways, has provided some unwelcome rocket fuel for the darker side of the immigration debate. Well, our concern in these moments, and of course I can only touch on a few themes, is to see what the Bible says into that debate. And the answer is, when we look at it, quite a lot. Because this is a subject where the Bible teaching has powerful validity, because so many of the Bible writers knew exactly what alienation and exile and dispossession felt like. As Lord Sacks, the former chief rabbi, writes, who writes brilliantly on some of these matters, put it, Israelites learned from the inside what it feels like to be an outsider, an alien, a stranger. So I've got a seminal text from a great ethical chapter in the Old Testament, and I've got four suggestions for its application. The text is there in Leviticus 19, 33 and 34. Let's look at it. When a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not ill-treat them. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native born. Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. I am the Lord your God. This chapter is a marvelous one. It's about how everyone can invest in what we call social capital. It covers every one of the Ten Commandments except the first. But it's not to be approached like a statute book for the courts. Rather, it's to educate the people of God in the will of God for the whole of their life as his people. These rules aren't primarily a matter of social convenience. Rather, verse 2 of the chapter, they are a matter of divine holiness. That's the point. Be holy because I, the Lord, am holy. That is the extraordinary invitation in this verse, which is probably the keynote message of the whole book of Leviticus. And if that's the keynote message of the whole book, the epicenter of application is there in verses 17 and 18, culminating in verse 18b, love your neighbor as yourself. Words we know so well. Everybody knows Jesus' story of the Good Samaritan. Here's where he got the seed idea. Luke 10:27. Biblical holiness, you see, it's not a private experience. It's a community affair, how I treat other people. And remember, by the way, Samaritans were the then much disliked immigrants of their day. That's the point of the story when Jesus tells it. How we treat people matters. That's the message of this chapter. So move your eye for a moment from the familiarity of verse 18 to the perhaps less familiar verse 34. What else are you to love as yourself? Answer, the foreigner residing among you. The ger in Hebrew, plural gerim, the resident alien, the sojourner, in our thinking, immigrants. And it's a noun used 92 times in the Old Testament. People from another ethnic background who have taken up long-term residence in Israel. We're not to ill-treat them. We're to treat them as native-born. We're to love them as ourselves. You know, long before the race relations industry got into gear, God said there was only one attitude to immigrants, which is consistent with holiness. And that's love. The responsibility to welcome the stranger is stated at least 36 times in the Old Testament. It's the most frequently repeated command after the call to worship God himself. Extraordinary, isn't it? So it's not a suggestion we welcome immigrants. It's a command. And it's a command not given once, but dozens of times. This is really my first point. It's there. Recognize the issue. The Bible knows all about the complexities and the adjustments and the inconveniences that immigrants sometimes bring about. often then as now, the reality is they are poor, landless, vulnerable people. And yes, of course, the biblical world was very different to ours. Of course. But here is perhaps the first timeless principle, the real big issue. But, you know, immediately, I can feel someone thinking, oh, here we go. Another touchy-feely Christian talk, out of touch with the realities, bearing no relation to the real issues. Well, I hope not. I hope not. Because I know there is a Romans 13 side to the illegalities of immigration. There are questions in this debate not simply of humanity and mercy, but of legality and justice. You know, as a judge, I've had to imprison scores of people coming into the major airport in my patch on false documents. I've had to recommend immigrants for deportation who are serious criminals. I've tried scores of cases of document fraud and of people trafficking. And I've had to look every single one of these people in the face as I've made the decisions. No serious politician argues that there shouldn't be controls or management or standards. The manifestos, which I've looked at, have in many ways a remarkable overlap of interest with fine-tuning here or there. As Nick Clegg said in the recent TV debate, we want to be open for business, but not open for abuse. And it's good that bogus language schools have been shut down. It's good that sham marriages have been reduced. It's good that endless appeals are being rejected, that benefit and health tourism are restricted, that gangmasters and slave labor is controlled. Those are all good things, aren't they? But there's a bottom line in verse 34. The Bible doesn't assume anything there about legal or illegal immigrants. It doesn't tell us how or if or whether we should set quotas or award points. It doesn't tell us how we should manage our detention centers or our immigration control. It doesn't say that there is a right number, in inverted commas, at which we should stop. It doesn't say any of those things. It does say there is a non-negotiable way to treat people. Now, we haven't time this morning to look at the marvelous and fascinating passages in Exodus and Deuteronomy which spell out what it meant to treat someone as your native born. Why it involved protection from abuse, oppression, economic exploitation, unfair treatment in the courts, Exodus 20. It guaranteed harvest gleanings. Do you see that in our chapter, Leviticus 19, verses 9 and 10? You didn't take the crops right to the edge of the field. You didn't go over your vineyard twice. It encouraged fair employment practice, Deuteronomy 24, and even laterally in Ezekiel 47, it gave the opportunity to own rural land. But just as Gerim immigrants who assimilated had equal rights, so they faced equal prohibitions and equal punishments. To love someone is not necessarily to tolerate all that they do, or to excuse their bad behavior, or to avoid setting restrictions on their freedom. No, love is not the same as liberty. Here's a second point. Renounce the rhetoric. Hebrew has a number of words to characterize migrants. Gerim is just one of them. We haven't time to look at the others. But perhaps the lesson for us is to use language very carefully in this area. Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, who we hope is somewhere on the marathon course as we speak, is an immigrant. So too are the Romanian guys who occasionally sleep on the church steps outside. Immigrants include Russian oligarchs buying up Kensington and overstayers scraping by on our streets. It was ever thus. I love that I'm an immigrant poster campaign. You may have seen some of them running. 30% of medical doctors in the UK are immigrants. So let's never be drawn into that loose talk of those people. Let's avoid that, you know, floods of immigrants swamping our shores, taking our jobs sort of nonsense. Let's always resist irresponsible rhetoric that disparages or dehumanizes or detaches. How horrible to read of Sun columnist Katie Hopkins talking about immigrants as cockroaches. Unless we think it's only a white or European issue, how sad to hear of Zulu King Goodwill's Zwelithini telling fellow African migrants in the Republic of South Africa to pack their bags, for they were lice. It's no surprise that in Durban and Johannesburg recently, there have been beatings and killings and lootings. No, Christians haven't got all the answers here. But we can set a tone that resists crass generalization, aggressive polemic, open resentment, and even, friends, wearied toleration. And, you know, the statistics help us here, because while over 70% say there is a real anxiety about immigration nationally, the statistics say that only 20% say they have a problem with immigrants in their locality. And by implication, that means that 80% do not. The bottom line of Leviticus 19 is that immigrants are people. People of equal importance to us. Their families are no less important than ours. They too are in the image of God, and so are their children. And that's true whether they're here legally or illegally, whether they're high net worth individuals, or whether they only have the clothes they stand up in. And people always come before politics. Here's a third thought. Remember the Bible's story. The clue is there at the end of verse 34. Do you see that? Love them as yourself, for you were foreigners in Egypt. The GER, the immigrant experience, weaves its way through the whole experience of Israel. God, time after time, has used movement of people so vividly to accomplish his greater purposes. Never forget this. Never forget this. God is still in control of this whole immigration debate, and he may well be working in Europe in ways which we do not even begin to see or expect or understand. He's in control. But think of the immigration motif in the Bible story. As a consequence of sin, Adam and Eve lived in exile, a place of pain and hard work. They were immigrants. We meet Abraham called to leave a home and a land and a culture and yet required to maintain an identity. Joseph is trafficked to another country and as an immigrant works his way up to a place of power and influence. Moses had to lead the people from a tyrannical regime and from persecution to a new land. In which new land there were plenty of problems and challenges of its own. Ruth was an immigrant into Israel. Like many immigrants today, she left her homeland for the sake of family unity. God used her migration and subsequent marriage to Boaz to form part of the lineage of Jesus the Messiah. And her great-grandson David, third-generation immigrant, became Israel's greatest king. And Jesus himself. Have you ever thought of Jesus as, well, a divine immigrant? Coming to experience the rejection of the world and the hatred and the knocks and the injustices. Labeled an outsider. Undergoing displacement for our salvation. Spending his childhood in Egypt away from the wider family, speaking a different language. God's special concern for immigrants is there, in that, in the fullness of time, he becomes an immigrant himself. And then think about the early church. God used the persecution and the dispersion of Christ followers to spread the gospel across the Middle East and beyond. And what's the language of our Christian experience today, which the New Testament uses? Why? Hebrews 11, verse 13, we're foreigners and strangers on earth. Have you reflected on that? Verse 16, we're longing for a better country ourselves as Christian people. 1 Peter 2:11, we're foreigners and exiles. Philippians 3:20, our citizenship means that we do not now belong to any nation state, but to the kingdom of God. What does all that mean? We were, Ephesians 2:12, excluded from citizenship, foreigners to the covenants of promise, without hope and without God in the world, until the extraordinary, undeserved, unmerited outpouring of grace occurred, which made us Christ's. And where does the Bible story end? Well, in Revelation 7, 9 and 10, in the new creation, a place of multicultural cohabitation. Yes, there are countless people there, but they are by no means colorless. And where in Revelation 21, 26, the peoples of the earth will bring into it the glory and honor of the nations. And as Vinod Ramachandra, one of our mission partners, has written, this eschatological horizon should keep Christians from presumption. We just don't know which aspects of any culture or tradition, including our own, will be there. So let's never be too pleased with ourselves at the expense of others. Recognize the issue the Bible does. Renounce the rhetoric Christians can set a tone. Remember the Bible's story. It is shot through with the motif of immigration and longing for a better country and homelessness. Well, I've just time for a fourth thought. Here it is. Reflect God's character. We're now migrants on this earth. And the more we get involved and immerse ourselves in the lives of migrants, the better we shall understand the gospel and its breathtaking generosity. And when we do that, why? We reflect the very character of God. And that's the raison d'etre of this text. Verse 34, I am the Lord your God. When we love immigrants, as verse 34 requires, it's nothing to do with our political views. It's all about reflecting the very heart of God's character. And it's his character to take delight in loving the other, just as he's done for us, especially if they're economically and socially vulnerable. See, Israel was a nation of others. In Egypt, that's the point of the verse, they were scapegoated by acts of xenophobic violence when national fortunes had declined. So Yahweh, true to his character, loves them and rescues them. Dishonor or ill-treat immigrants, and you in fact dishonor or ill-treat God. And you know, friends, we need the confidence and the calm in this debate, to live by the gospel and to trust God's control and not to be too fazed by the rhetoric. Well, time has gone. I offer these very inadequate reflections as part of a subject of profound significance. And you know, all souls here, this church, is a wonderful church to try to work some of this out. We pride ourselves, we rejoice in being a loving multicultural community for Christ in what is now probably the greatest cosmopolitan city in the world. What a privilege that is. What a gospel opportunity. What a challenge to Leviticus 19 discipleship. Look around you. send the foreigners home? It's a grotesque thought. Yes, we may have our moments, but this is a foretaste of heaven. This is what it's going to be like, but immeasurably better. And what a joy that is. I've not got time now to talk about the practicalities of immigration involved, what we're trying to do here. There are all sorts of things going on through international student work, in English classes that we run, with trafficked people and in small groups of all kinds to which people can commit. Building relationships and friendships and culture across the races. No, Christians haven't got all the answers in this debate. But we can do and model the gold standard, can't we? And we can do that here in the church. And as Jim Wallace likes to say, Christians can't always change the policies, but they can, as he puts it, change the wind. You change society, writes Jim Wallace, by changing the wind. You transform the debate. You alter the context in which political discussions and decisions are made. You change the outcomes. You would be surprised, he said, at how politicians adjust to a change in the wind. And we've got an opportunity in the church to change the wind. And the very fine Jubilee Center has just put out a good booklet, Immigration and Justice, How Local Churches Can Change the Debate on Immigration in Britain. And the second half of the book is packed with wonderful ideas. I recommend it to you. In a recent sermon at a Think, Pray, Vote conference, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, was surely echoing our text when he said this: the distinguishing feature of Christian involvement in politics should be that compelling, fire-raising, wonderful, illuminating, transforming, revolutionary power of love applied indiscriminately and lavishly. Well, may it be so in all souls. And for each one of us, as we love not only our neighbor, but also the strangers and the sojourners and the aliens and the immigrants who are in increasing numbers on our doorstep. Let's be quiet for a moment. Lord Jesus Christ, you've called us to love three sets of people: our neighbor, our enemy, and here we dare to believe, immigrant people. Lord, this isn't always easy, and we often fail and let you down. But our longing is that by your Spirit we might have your heart and mind and vision in this precious area, for your glory's sake. Amen.